Chairs No Waiting, episode number 516. Bruce Billison, 2015 interview, part one. Two Chairs No Waiting is brought to you each week by the folks over at WeaversDepartmentStore.com. Drop by over at Weavers, please, and check it out. You can pick up a fishing hole wooden throw. Not wooden, woven. Woven, not wooden. You can pick up a woven throw. Go check it out. You'll see what I'm talking about. It looks great. You can also pick up some Mayberry Patrol Car Emblem stickers. Head over to WeaversDepartmentStore.com and check it out. Two Chairs No Waiting is also brought to you by donations from listeners just like you. The executive producer of tonight's show is Danny Vinson. Danny, thank you so much for your donation to keep this show going. And thank you for being here with me in Mayberry. I'm Alan Newsom, your host for Two Chairs No Waiting, the Andy Griffith Show fan podcast. And have I got a show for you this evening, day, whenever you're listening to this. We have, in the past, back in 2016, January of 2016, there was a series of episodes, four parts, that we did about Bruce Billison. Bruce was the associate producer or director. Gosh, I can't get any of this right. I'm so excited. Associate director of the Andy Griffith Show from 1960 to through 1963. And we had a great series of interviews with him then, done by Neil Brower. Neil Brower is Professor Brower, if you've ever heard us talk about him here on the podcast. And he does a series of lectures called Professor Brower's Class that he has done at Mayberry Days in Mount Airy, North Carolina, every year. Now, this particular interview is Bruce's second interview done with Neil. The first one, as I said, was released here on the podcast back in 2016 in January. There are links in the show notes to go see those, and I recommend seeing them. There are videos for these. I definitely recommend watching those if you have an opportunity. Listening is great, but watching them, you'll be able to see some of the things he's showing. The same thing I would like to recommend for this episode and the coming weeks. You're really going to want at some point sit down and watch the episode so you get to see the pictures he's talking about and the video clips he shows. Because these are some amazing things that you really won't see anywhere else unless you were live there in Mayberry Days in 2015 or back when he was there in 2011. Because these are two separate interviews. They're different. He came back in 2015 to give us more information and share more Mayberry knowledge with us. So, wow, I'm excited to bring you that. Don't leave after it's over because we've got Randy Turner in This Week in Mayberry History bringing us information about Charlie Ruggles. That's right. Wow. Just jam-packed. So, folks, let's go on and get this thing started. This is part one of Bruce Billison's interview from 2015 Mayberry Days. All right? And I know you're going to love it. So just sit back and enjoy the show. It is amazing. Thank you.
Director Bruce Billison.
Well, Bruce, you all came. That's great.
Bruce, when did you last come to Mayberry Days?
4 years ago, 2011.
And at that time, you told me you probably wouldn't come back again because you thought you had said everything that you knew to say about the Andy Griffith Show. Why are you back this year?
Well, I got that bulletin from the Mayberry chapter that said, who is that woman we call Nice Dress Nellie? Or sometimes Ellie. I've seen it spelled both ways. And of course I knew. And I'm not telling. But I will later. Okay? But when I started thinking about what I knew that you guys don't know yet, I realized I could come back and sort of tell you about how we made the show, what it took to make 1 half hour of the Andy Griffith Show. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight, mainly.
Tell us how you got the job as assistant director of the Andy Griffith Show.
Well, it was luck. I had taken my family and moved to the Philippines to take a job on a series that was being done over there because I felt I might get a chance to direct. I had been an assistant director, mostly at Desilu for like 8 years, and I was trying to become a director. I went over there, And my job was to make sure that that show was enough good quality to be on American television. And after we had made about six of them, the man from ABC Network came over, and we took him in and showed him some film. And there was a scene of a ship, right? And the captain of the ship said, "Get off my seat!" The guy looked at me and said, "What the hell did he say?" I said, "He said, get off my ship." So I knew that was not going to be a good job. I had tuned in my ear to the Philippine vernacular. So I came home, and I was out of work, and I went to Desilu, where I had worked before, and I was walking down the street. Now, I had grown a little beard, and there was Argyle Nelson walking toward me. Argyle Nelson was the head of production. He hired all the production managers on every Desilu show and all the assistant directors. And I was glad to see him. I said, "Hi, Argy," and he walked right by. So I went home. I said, "Honey, the beard's going." Shaved the beard, came back a week later, walking down, and there he was. I said, "Hi, Argy. How are you, boy? Good to see you. Bruce, listen, I think I may have a job for you." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Something new. We're calling it the Andy Griffith Show." And that was how luck works, because it could have been a different show that was starting, but that's the show. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know I would be sitting here today. So I went to work the first day, and I saw the pilot. Oh, that's nice. They go to a little small town, and the sheriff, and another guy. Good, nice, we can do that. And then I got the script, I read it, and we went on location on Monday. And Sheldon Leonard, who was a big boss there, was directing it himself. And we went, there's a dirt road and a lake. I said, "Roll camera." That was my job, that was my line. And Sheldon said, "Action." And Andy Griffith, there he was, walking down this road with a little red-headed kid. And the kid comes to the lake and he throws a rock and it doesn't go in the lake. So, okay, take two, roll camera, action. Comes walking down the road, little red-headed kid, I guess the thing, throws the rock, doesn't go in the lake. So I said to the prop guy, "Listen, go behind that bush, and when I say throw it, you throw it into the lake, okay?" So now we go down the road, roll it, action, comes walking down the road, the little red-headed kid throws the rock, I said, "Throw it!" Goes in the lake, but it was a little late. A little late, and you're going to see that right now, okay? If you'll roll it, Ken. The rock sort of goes a little slow. See what you think.
The Andy Griffith Show, starring Andy Griffith with Ronnie Howard. Also starring Don Knotts.
Okay.
Now, this would have been the second season opening, and it's a little different from the first.
Yes, so what happened? The sponsor took over the splash. Watch this. Now.
Starring Andy Griffith. With Ronnie Howard. Also starring Don Knotts. Brought to you by Coke. Bigger than Coke 10. 10 little bit better reasons for breakfast. Coke 10.
Start your day a little bit better, oh B.
Start your day with the cereal from Post.
Birdie, start your day a little bit better, ain't B.
Better start off with the Post.
Nice, with a little bit better cereal. Fresh from Post, extra good.
Bruce, this was shot on location. And
right.
Tell us where this was shot.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, I was on the show for 2 years, and for about 3 years afterward, good was still a two-syllable word for me. It was always good. I carried that with me for a while. What would you ask me?
This opening was shot at Franklin Reservoir.
Right, Franklin Canyon Reservoir, which is a lake in the hills just above Beverly Hills. And it's part of the drinking water system for Beverly Hills. So whenever we had to put something in the lake like a boat, it was a big deal. We had to scrub it with chlorine first and make sure that we didn't drop anything into it. It was very carefully monitored. But it was close, and it was looked good. And I don't know if it looked like North Carolina to you, but it looked good to us. And I went back to look at it last week because we've had a drought, as you know. And it was sort of a sad sight. I chose not to show the picture. But the lake was way down. There were weeds growing, kind of greenish. But it's also a recreation area, and there are hiking paths all around, and there were people all around. But the lake was a little sad.
We're going to talk about the studio now.
Very
good. Andy Griffith's show was shot at the Desilu Studio, and you have some stills that you want to share with us.
Let's see what happens. Nothing. There it is. Okay, let me get where I can see what I'm doing. Okay, so this is where we work. This is the studio. Desilu had just bought it. It was an independent lot. It was now called Desilu Cahuenga. These two stages, one and two, is where Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz worked, where Dick Van Dyke worked. And this little stage was stage seven, actually, where one camera shows could be made. I worked there on a show called Wyatt Earp and another show called Whirlybirds when I was an assistant director. And here, stage three and four, was where we shot the Andy Griffith Show. Danny Thomas was over here. Red Skelton was here. Later in my life, I shot 25 shows of Hogan's Heroes right there. But for the Andy Griffith Show, stage three and stage four. Right over here was the gate. Don't mind the shaking, I'm 87 years old. Right here was the gate, and we all parked out here. Nobody parked on the lot, except they let Aunt B drive in, and she had a little parking place somewhere over there. Had one of those Studebakers that looked like it was coming and going, you know? So there was a guard here at the gate called Tiny, who was not Tiny. And there was another gate around there. I'll show you a picture of that in a minute, where Harry was. Harry was an older security guard, okay? And what else do I want to say? Over here, am I in the way?
Yep.
Right on this corner is where Rance Howard had rented a house or owned it, I don't know, but that's where Ronnie lived. So that he could go home from school, home for lunch, home when he was finished with his work and so on. It was just one of the many things I'll tell you about Rance Howard and Gene, his parents, and how wonderful they were. So that was the studio. Now, a couple of things happened. By the time we... Well, you see it. Okay. By the time we got on the air, we had made like 10 or 12 episodes. And nobody had seen them. Not only the crew, but the public had not seen them. They came on Monday evening, and Tuesday morning we all came to work. And I was in the makeup room with Don and Andy and Lee Greenway, the makeup man, Bob Sweeney, the director, and me. And we said, "How'd you take the show last night?" "It was pretty good, wasn't it?" "Yeah." And somebody said, "Boy, everybody I talked to said it was great." And Don said, "Yeah, everybody I talked to really liked it." And I said, "Boy, I told my wife loved it, and everybody I talked to loved it." And Andy said, "Yeah." He said, "When I came in this morning, Tiny at the gate said, 'Great show.'" And I said, "Well, that's who I heard it from." Don said, "That's who I heard it from." And Lee said, "That's who I heard it from." And so the five of us had decided that America loved us because Tiny at the gate said, "Great show." I have to tell you that every Tuesday for 2 years, Tiny at the gate said, "Great show last night, Bruce." So that's one story about it. The other story is a little different. On our stage were the dressing rooms, and they were little, they called them portable, but they didn't move while we had the series. And they were like 10 by 10, and they were lined up with their backs to a stage wall. And there was like Ronnie's room, and he had a school room, and there was makeup, and Don, and Andy, and B, and a couple for guest stars, because every actor has to have a place to change. It's union rules. And one day, coming back from lunch, one of the guys was looking, and behind the dressing rooms, there was a guy making a hole in the back of Aunt B's dressing room, a peeping Tom. So he yelled at him, and the guy came running, and let me see. So he came running out of here, right? And he, am I right? Yeah. And he came running down the street, and he started for the other gate. And Harry was at the other gate, right? And all of a sudden, this guy's running at him, and eight guys are chasing him and said, "Stop him, Harry! Get that guy!" And Harry came out, right? And Harry had a gun. So he pulled the gun out, and he said, "Halt!" And he fired in the air. And then he started shaking and went to his knees, and a guy ran by. And eight guys came and said, "Harry, are you all right?" And they cared about him, and the guy went away, and nothing ever came of it. But the studio, those gates were wide open. They weren't like open or closed. City.
Let's see the other steals that you have, Bruce.
Yeah, let's go on. Thank you. Keep me going. So I push this. It works great when it's by accident. Here we are. So these are our stages. Stage 2, 3, and 4. And back in there was the gate right there. And that's where Tiny was, right? And that's the size of the doors. The sets went in and out. And the dressing rooms were at this end. And down the other way was the office and the house, interior of the house. And the interior of the barbershop, which we're going to talk about a lot later. And let's see what else I've got. This is the gate. And Tiny was right over there, the little door, you can see it. And we came in, and this was our stage right here. So we came in every morning, and there he was. Great show last night, right? And just trying to give you an idea of it. There's the front gate. As you can see, it was just a wide open right there, and that Harry was like further in there. And this is the little house. It's now a little studio called Stars, a post-production studio. But as you can see, this is the house where Ronnie lived with his family, and Clint, who's the right Clint, right?
Yeah. It was a house, too.
Yeah, it was a house. And there's the stage right behind it, see? The studio is right there.
How many shows did you do that first year?
We did 32 shows. And that's part of what I want to talk about, is what it takes to do 32 shows. We would do one a week. That was our schedule, 3 days shooting, one a week. And we would go like maybe 8 weeks and then take a week off, where they could catch up on scripts, and the actors, sometimes they had to go make public appearances somewhere, or somebody just get off the schedule for a week. Most shows do that. Then we do like another 8 or 9 and take another hiatus week, and so on until we finish the season.
What would take place on Thursday? Explain to us the week.
The week? Yes, I will. Our show, we had to do one a week, was a 5-day week. And our week started on Thursday. On Thursday morning, we would have... I wonder if I should talk about how to get the scripts first. That's okay. Let me tell you what it took to get a script for the Andy Griffith Show. Aaron Rubin, as I thought you've all heard me talk about, was the man, the producer of the show. And writers would come, freelance writers, they were not under contract, would come to him and say, "We've got an idea for your show, a pitch, as it was called." And sometimes he was telling writers that, you know, here's an idea we have. What do you guys think you can do with it? Other times they would come with an idea and they would pitch it to him. And if he liked it, he would give them the assignment, go ahead, start, work on it. And they would go home and they would make what we call a treatment, which was like write out the story. It was not the dialogue, but it was they'd put in the jokes that they felt were important and the values that were important, and they would bring it back and they would go over it again with Aaron. He would make his notes, they would even go back, and now they would write the first draft, and that was the script. And they would write that and bring it back, and Aaron would go over it with them again, make some changes. When that was done, as Neil pointed out to me, they finally got paid the first half of their fee, and then went home and wrote the second draft and turned it in. And that draft was then printed and distributed to the crew, and particularly to the state, to the production manager, who would then have this production meeting on Thursday morning with all the technical people, wardrobe, sound, camera, props, set dressing, set design, art director, all those people, and they would have a production meeting based on that script, so that everybody was under control and knew what they were doing, and it was going to go ahead and be ready for next Monday when we started shooting. At 10 o'clock that Thursday, the cast came in and read the script. But now it was Sheldon Leonard, the executive producer, Aaron Rubin, the producer, Bob Sweeney, the director, and me and the cast, and Hazel Hall, who was the script supervisor. A very important person, which I'll tell you about as we go along. And we weren't reading this week's script, we were reading next week's script. And that would be that second draft that came in on that script. And the cast would read it, and it would be discussed, and comments would be made by Sheldon, often by Andy, often by Aaron, and Hazel would take notes, and that script went back to Aaron Rubin, who would rewrite it before the next Thursday. And then we would read the script that he had rewritten from last Thursday, and the cast would read it, and maybe there'd be a few comments, and then Don and Andy, Bob Sweeney, Aaron Rubin, me, and Hazel Hall went to Aaron Rubin's office and did like a fine tune starting on page one. Any comments from Andy, any comments from Don, from Aaron, suggestion things, and all those were taken by Hazel in hand, longhand, in her script, right? And when that script was finished, she gave it to me when that meeting was over, and I took it. Anybody remember what mimeograph is? Yeah. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, okay. I took it to the lady who did the mimeographing, and she had to retype the whole script, put all those changes in it, run it off on the mimeograph, and by Friday morning, 20 new scripts were delivered to our stage. And I remember one thing, and I'd never forgotten it, and we were reading a script and going over it, and Don was all sort of into this thing. He had a little scrap of paper, and he kept writing stuff. And finally, he stopped and he said, "Hey, Ang," he said, "I just learned the lawman's code. Test me on it." And here's what happened.
Morning, Barney.
Hi, Andy.
What's doing?
I was just memorizing these sheriff rules.
Oh.
I got the first one all memorized.
Had you?
Want to just check me on it?
Oh, all right.
I know the whole thing.
Okay. Rule number one. All right, go ahead.
You want to just give me the first word?
Okay. Ann.
Sure.
I'm looking right at it.
Ann. You want to just give me the second word?
Okay. An officer.
Oh, yeah. An officer. An officer. An officer.
An officer of the what?
An officer of the what? That don't sound right.
No, no, that ain't right. An officer of the law.
Oh, yeah, an officer of the law. An officer of the law. An officer of the law. Officer of the law. Law.
Shall.
An officer of the law shall
enforce
the law
and order
without regard
to personal
welfare
and safety. Pretty good. You want to go over it again? You think you got it?
I got it.
Now, Bruce, you said that that was Don's idea. Would Andy and he have worked out a lot of the dialogue, or would have Aaron Rubin have taken then that idea and written what?
Well, I think Aaron wrote it, and I think Don and Andy rehearsed it with Sween. And because it's in a two-shot and it's in close-ups and everything matches, it was rehearsed and done brilliantly, and I think that's what everybody knew. They had a great sidekick for Andy on this series.
Oh my, folks, if you guys aren't enjoying this, I don't know. I'm not sure about you. I'm worried about you. So this is part one only. Do not go away. Stick around for these. Don't leave yet either for this episode. But wow, Bruce Billison, he has so much information and knowledge, and he enjoys sharing it. And this was such a special time. Definitely, if you have not heard the original series of interviews that we did with Bruce, go back and check them out, because it starts on episode number 360 of the podcast. So you can head over there and go into that. It's called Neil Brower Interviews Bruce Billison, 2011. So go and check that out, and you can listen to those, because he gives a lot of this, not this same information, but amazing information in this background like this. So definitely do not miss it. So I hope you're enjoying that. We've got also, you know, he talked about the Studebaker that Aunt Bee drove. Well, there's a website about that. So if you just go and search for it, you search for Francis Bavier car, you'll find Aunt Bee's Studebaker. There's pictures and stuff of it. So don't miss out on that. All right. So let's go and hear from Randy Turner with This Week in Mayberry History.
Welcome to This Week in Mayberry History, a report by special correspondent Randy Turner of the Gomer and Cooper Pyle Comic Book Literary Guild of the Mayberry Historical Society.
Charlie Ruggles was born on February the 8th, 1886, in Los Angeles, and had a career that spanned more than six decades, with a stop in Mayberry toward the end of it. Charlie actually trained to be a physician, but found himself drawn to the stage. He appeared in a professional stage production before he was 20, and continued stage acting as a career. In 1913, he appeared in a stage musical called Tick-Tock Man of Oz, based on the eighth book in the Wizard of Oz series. The following year, he appeared in a silent film version of the seventh Oz book, The Patchwork Girl of Oz, that was actually written by L. Frank Baum, the author of the book series. Charlie moved to New York in 1914 to continue his stage work and made his Broadway debut in the play Help Wanted. For the next 15 years, Charlie was a busy Broadway actor, appearing in an additional 11 plays and musicals between then and 1929. During that same period, he appeared in three more silent films and transitioned into talkies in another four films. Throughout the 1930s, Charlie appeared in 58 more films. He was often paired with comic actress Mary Boland in a string of films in which they played married couples involved in a variety of hijinks. An early example is the 1934 comedy Six of a Kind, which also included in the cast W.C. Fields, George Burns, and Gracie Allen. In 1933, Charlie also began performing on radio. He often appeared in anthology shows, as well as guest starring in series. He performed periodically in the medium for roughly 25 years, crossing paths in the process with Howard McNear and Parley Bear when they appeared in productions together. In the 1938 screwball comedy Bringing Up Baby, starring Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, Charlie had one of his best-remembered roles as big game hunter Major Applegate. The film has been placed in the Library of Congress's National Film Registry for its cultural significance and is often in the top 100 films of all time lists. During the 1940s, Charlie appeared in dozens more films, including one which gave him the second role for which he is best remembered. He played a millionaire whose mansion was used by a hobo during the winter while Charlie's character was away in the 1947 classic It Happened on Fifth Avenue. Alan Hale Jr. and Charles Lane were also in the cast. In 1949, Charlie transitioned back to stage work and also began appearing in television. Charlie starred as a character with his same name in The Ruggles, an early family comedy that co-starred Margaret Carey as one of his children. After the series ended, Charlie appeared in a variety of shows as a guest star, such as The Life of Riley, The Real McCoys, and Wagon Train. He was also the voice of Aesop in the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons Aesop and Son segments. In 1961, Charlie played a role that is likely better remembered by modern viewers than the two earlier film roles for which he is best known. He played the grandfather of the twins in the original film version of The Parent Trap. In the 1965 episode Aunt Bee the Swinger, Charlie played retired Congressman John Canfield, who returned to Mayberry and began seeing Aunt Bee, with both pushing themselves past their limits while not wanting the other to think they couldn't keep up. Shortly thereafter, Charlie began playing the recurring character of Milburn Drysdale's father-in-law in the Beverly Hillbillies. Charlie passed away in 1970 at the age of 84. He has three stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He has one for his work in motion pictures, one for radio, and one for television. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and remember to take Andy's advice and go out there and act like somebody.
Thank you, Randy, for that great report, as always. Folks, if you don't want to miss any of the fun Mayberry stuff Randy does online, send him an email at turnersgrade@gmail.com, and he'll make sure you don't miss anything. So, folks, I hope you have enjoyed yourself. You came to Mayberry. I hope you enjoyed it. And, wow, that's a lot of neat information. Now, this may not be your cup of tea. And if it isn't, well, the next several weeks are going to be long because we got probably, I think, four more episodes of this interview with Bruce. And he's joined later by Clint Howard. He joins him on stage for one segment. It'll be toward the end of the interview. But I think you're really going to continue to enjoy this because it's just got more and more background information that he's providing from the show. Now, if you noticed during Randy's report, he talked about the fact that Margaret Carey appeared in The Ruggles with Charles Ruggles. Now, Margaret Carey is, remember, Bess Muggins. She's the wife on the Christmas episode. She's also another one as well, but that just reminds you who Margaret is. If you don't know, go through search at twochairsnowaiting.com. Search for Margaret Carey, and there's a lot of information there. We had a great interview with her as well. Folks, I again want to thank you for being here. Share the love of Mayberry. Get out there and tell people about it. And as part of that, I want to do a special thanks to Neil and Pat Coleman from the Remembering Mayberry chapter of the Andy Griffith Show, Rio and Rutgers Club, for providing the great video and audio, if you're listening, to this episode from Professor Brower's class back in 2015 at Mayberry Days. So thank you to Neil and Pat. I really want to encourage you, if you listened to this episode, you might want to go back and watch the video. You don't have to see a lot of me in the video, so it's mostly Bruce and Neil. So I encourage you to go see that. Folks, get out there and tell people about the Andy Griffith Show and about Mayberry. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can head over to patreon.com/twochairs and donate. We'll see you guys next time.